Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Tom and Laura Kaiser, the appellants versus Sioux Valley Hospital University Physicians Clinic, and Elizabeth Dmitriovich, appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Ms. Melissa Hinton, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. The court should note that Justice Meyer Henry has recused herself from participating in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Eugene Dauberpool, the retired presiding judge of the Fifth Judicial Circuit from Aberdeen, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's place. Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. On one level, this is a very complicated case. The trial transcript is 10 volumes, the medical issues are extremely complex, and the case turns on conflicting expert testimony. On another level, the case can be distilled into really a central and singular medical mystery. How did foreign vegetable matter come to be deposited on Laura Kaiser's uterus inside her body? And does that establish that a bowel injury occurred during her cesarean section and causing an infection that nearly ended her life? But on an appellate level, the case is really very simple, and the issue is very simple. And that is, can a party use previously undisclosed exhibits and expert testimony at trial, having never provided them to the other side? Is that fair? Should the rules of discovery be enforced, or are they bendable? Are they suggestions? The trial court below remarked quite correctly that there really is not a South Dakota case that directly addresses this type of circumstance. So this appeal offers the opportunity to provide some unambiguous guidance on what the South Dakota rules of discovery provide for, what they require. Laura Kaiser respectfully requests that this judgment be reversed because her trial was not fair because of the use of undisclosed exhibits during the expert's testimony. It was about 1 in the morning on Tuesday, September 17, 2002. Dr. Dmitriovich was called out of bed, came to the office, and about 1 in the morning, she performed a cesarean section on Laura Kaiser. The operation seemed to go very well, and a healthy baby boy named Spencer was born, and he's more than 3 years old today, and he's doing very well. By about Thursday, Laura began to become very sick. On Saturday, Dr. Maria Bell was called in to take over Laura's care. And the following Tuesday, 1 week after the cesarean section, Dr. Bell and Dr. George performed emergency surgery on Laura Kaiser. When they opened her up, and there's a tab in our brief that shows what they saw. But when they opened her up, it was an infection more massive than either of those physicians had ever seen in their decades of experience. You could not see her organs. They were covered with so much pus. The infection was so terrible. Dr. Bell and Dr. George saved Laura Kaiser's life that day. But for Laura Kaiser, the cycle of life ended, and all of her reproductive organs were removed, and that has affected her substantially, physiologically, emotionally. It's affected her marriage and her life. Dr. Ort, the treating pathologist at Sioux Valley, performed the post-op, examined the evidence to try to figure out why, what had gone so horribly wrong in the cesarean section. Why did this infection occur? And he found two very startling clues. The first was that in the peritoneal cavity, which is a naturally sterile environment, there were two bacteria that are commonly found in the bowel, universally acknowledged as bowel flora, bowel bacteria, and that's what caused the infection. Also, foreign vegetable matter was discovered in two places on the small 7-micron sections that Dr. Ort examined of her uterus. Foreign vegetable matter of some kind, plant material of some kind. It's not that the foreign vegetable matter caused the infection, it's that the foreign vegetable matter is a marker of a bowel injury, the plaintiffs contended. And the bowel injury would have spilled the bacteria into the peritoneal cavity. So we have bowel bacteria and foreign vegetable matter in her peritoneal cavity. All the experts at trial agreed that these were entirely consistent and indicators of a bowel injury that was undetected during Mrs. Kaiser's cesarean section. Of course, under our system of laws, everyone is responsible for their negligent acts, whether we're driving a car, whether we're practicing law, or whether we're performing surgery. And our courts are governed by rules. One of the most basic rules that each side is entitled to equal access to all of the relevant evidence, and that includes expert testimony. We don't like trials by surprise anymore. They make for wonderful television, but they are deleterious to the administration of justice. And the reason is that when evidence comes in that is unknown previously, it is essentially unchallengeable. It cannot be tested. Trials are about testing evidence. And when evidence cannot be tested, cannot be challenged, the jury is unable to make an objective evaluation of the facts and apply the applicable law. The defendants, there are many experts in this case, but the defendant's expert pathologist was Dr. Dale Snover. The defendants were served with discovery requiring Dr. Snover to produce all of his opinions, all photographs, all materials he was relying upon. In his substantive answer to his interrogatories, he said, "I believe that the foreign vegetable matter was not the cause of the infection." In his deposition, he elaborated, and he said, "Well, one of the reasons is that the rate of giant cell formation, in my view, was not consistent with a bowel injury that occurred a week prior." Now, when a foreign body is located somewhere, or a foreign substance is lodged in the body somehow, whether it's plant matter or whatever it is, something called histiocytes produce giant cells. There's a process that takes place, but the result are giant cells are produced. These are multi-nuclei cells, and their job is to surround and attack the foreign substance, digest it. Actually, there are enzymes in there, other chemicals that either digest it or attempt to wall it off to protect the body. And Dr. Snover said, "Well, I just think that it would have taken too long for the, by the time that the infection occurred, giant cells should not have been there. But the rate is not consistent with how my experience is how the rate of giant cells form." In other words, it takes more than a week for them to get there. And if you look at her slides, the giant cells are already there. So he said it was impossible, in my view, that the foreign vegetable matter came from a bowel injury during the surgery because the giant cells shouldn't be there by then. He was asked specifically, "Do you have anything to support your opinions, your theory regarding the rate of giant cell formation?" He says, "No, no documentary evidence whatsoever. I looked in textbooks. I couldn't find anything to support what I'm saying."
What about photographs? Did he have any photographs that he showed during the deposition?
Not during his deposition, not of other patients. The only thing he had were the slides from Laura Kaiser. And he said, "Looking at Laura Kaiser's slides, this is inconsistent with my experience." Now, he's an experienced doctor. He's entitled to his opinions. But he assured plaintiff's counsel there was nothing documentary to support his theory. Turns out Sioux Valley's own pathologist, the treating pathologist, Dr. Orth, totally disagreed with the timetable presented by Dr. Snover. He testified at trial that giant cells could easily begin forming within 2 to 3 days after an injury, a foreign substance is lodged. Could take up to 2 weeks. And they occur, they can be present for years. You know, a bullet is lodged in your body, you'll have giant cells always around it. And that can be true of plant matter too. But the process begins within 2 or 3 days. Can begin. To 2 weeks. And here we had a solid week. Dr. Orth said it's entirely consistent, the rate of giant cell formation that I saw in Laura Kaiser's slides, with a bowel injury. So there's conflicting expert testimony. No one disputes that. Plaintiffs believe they were not getting answers to their requests for supplementation on a variety of things regarding a variety of experts. They brought a motion to compel, and they brought this to the court's attention about 2 months prior to trial. And Mark McNeary was the trial lawyer, who handled the hearing, and he is stating, as we point out in our brief, Judge, the reason for the motion, the reason for discovery is for us to do proper cross-examination. We don't want to get lambasted in the last moment. We are 2 months from trial. And he talks about Dr. Keegan and Dr. Snover having testified that they've had previous cases similar to this, and that's one of the things that we're asking them to produce. The court ordered that anything new had to be supplemented within 10 days of its acquisition, and the court said, I assume that if the doctor comes up with something new before trial, he'll divulge it. I don't see any problem with that. Counsel for the defense, do you have any problem with that? The defense counsel said, I would agree. Any time that an expert will rely upon something at trial, you supplement in your disclosure. You say this is new information that he's going to rely upon, and we don't have a problem with that.
Mr. Parsons, let me stop you right there. It's important for me to get the timetable down. That passage you just read talks about 10 days, and as I understand the record, technically this probably wouldn't have been a violation of 10 days. Was there any other agreement to provide information that would have been less than 10 days?
Well, the order was entered 2 months before trial. The information was disclosed during the second week of trial, 5 minutes before Dr. Snover testified. The court entered the order that anything would be supplemented within 10 days of acquisition. The court entered an order that all exhibits would be disclosed prior to trial. And South Dakota rules provide that anything new, SDCL 626E1, provides anything new regarding the substance of an expert's testimony must be supplemented. There's a duty to do that, regardless of any order. And then subsection 3 of that, as 26E, states also that anything that the court may order or the parties may agree that things will be produced if there are new things.
So what I'm asking, under the last subdivision, was there an agreement to supplement, or are you relying on the 10-day order?
We're relying on both. I would say the statements by the defense counsel at the hearing that we have no problem, we will supplement any new information, that constituted an agreement. There was not a written agreement.
So agreement as to what time frame, though, is what I'm getting at.
No. No.
Does the agreement imply a reasonable time?
I believe so. I think the point here, you know, if Dr. Snover is saying, well, I did this the night before, I'm not sure that's what he said, but obviously at some point Dr. Snover, before trial, as he's getting ready for trial, starts going to these other cases, and what he actually did was make photographs of slides from other patients, and he brought those in as a PowerPoint presentation, and he's essentially, second week of trial, these are handed to us. Right before he gets on the stand, there's a hearing outside the presence of the jury. We're desperately trying to keep these out. They're trying to get them in. The court says, I will allow it. And he takes these photographs.
Did you ask for a continuance at that point?
No continuance was sought at that point, no, Your Honor.
Why not?
At that point, the plaintiffs were in the second week of trial. All the experts had testified, had flown home. I suppose a continuance could have been requested. We're not claiming that an error of law is produced from the failure to grant a continuance. We're claiming that the use and admission and use and the testimony regarding these evidence was itself unfair surprise and an error. But no continuance was sought.
Thank you.
Back on the issue of how technical was the violation, when I read the transcript of that motion to compel, it looked to me like the lawyers were focused on the Medline search, not on photographs or other material. So is it reasonable to say that this agreement and this 10-day order were related more to Medline research than it was to photographs?
The original motion to compel certainly was directed primarily at literature that would support the opinions that were offered, and primarily related to literature regarding the bowel bacteria. The hearing expanded the issue, I believe. I mean, there, the representations were made and the court ordered. Anything new had to be produced. I don't think it was limited to just literature. And in fact, Mr. McNeary mentioned that there are other things. There are previous cases that these doctors have worked on that they mentioned, and we've been asking for that stuff too. So I believe the order covers it. Was there a technical violation of the rules? Absolutely, we think so. Were the spirit of the rules violated? Unquestionably. This evidence was pivotal. It was crucial. I'm not throwing stones at opposing counsel. Perhaps, I mean, it's totally possible there was nothing that they didn't know about this, that the expert had never told his own counsel about this new evidence he was coming to trial with. It may have been that that's the first time they ever saw the evidence was that morning, defense counsel.
Well, didn't your expert use documents or items on the stand that hadn't been furnished to the defense?
I believe there was some sort of medical exhibit diagram of body that was not furnished, yes. I don't believe that was objected to.
All right. You were talking about a matter of fairness at the beginning of your oral argument. Does that damage your argument today that you basically did the same thing?
I don't think so. I don't think the quality is the same. The diagram was a diagram of the body. I mean, that's not something that's a surprise to anyone, as I understand what the exhibit was. What we have here are essentially a comparative seminar given by their expert saying, I treat these cases. Here are the other cases I treat. This is what a bowel injury looks like. This is what foreign vegetable matter looks like. Here it is. Look, this has been digested. It doesn't look like what you see on Laura Kaiser's slides. Look at these two. I'm telling you, I've treated this patient. This is a bowel injury, and this doesn't look like this. The pictures don't lie. That's basically what the essence of the testimony was. Totally different than a diagram of a body, you know, something that's totally, purely demonstrative, I would suggest.
Would you elaborate on that a little bit? You know, exhibits, I think it was 10 and 11, were admitted for illustrative purposes, and I believe it was 8 went in for substantive purposes.
Correct.
What's your view of the law on the distinction between something that's illustrative and substantive, and where is that in the rules of evidence, that distinction?
Well, there is a statute that allows evidence to be admitted for limited purposes, including for illustrative purposes. It doesn't go to the jury.
Is that what Judge Sirska was talking about?
Yes.
Rule 105?
Yes. Judge Sirska admitted the first two exhibits for illustrative purposes. The effect on the trial, I think there is no distinction. These were put on the Elmo, blown up on the wall, and the jury saw them. The jury didn't have two of the exhibits in the jury room, but the pictures were up there, and he taught the jury that these things are what bowel injuries look like. These patients show that what happened in Laura Kaiser's case was not a bowel injury. So I think the effect on the trial, there is not a distinction. There is an evidentiary distinction, certainly.
Well, were these used to prove a fact, or were they used just to illustrate what a giant cell looks like?
I believe they were used to prove a fact.
And what was that?
The fact that they were used to prove is twofold. First, that these patients, these slides from these other patients, plaintiffs know nothing about the patients, but here they are. These slides show that the foreign material, the substance here, these are digested. These are bowel contents, and this is what bowel contents look like. They don't look like what you saw on Laura Kaiser's slide. The cell wall has been digested here, and you can tell that. Here on Laura Kaiser's slide, the cell wall is perfectly intact. It's lighter. It's a different size. Look at these. That, we suggest, is asking the jury to make an evidentiary conclusion, and it's using the exhibits not to illustrate, maybe to illustrate, but in addition to illustrating, to prove a point. And the essential point is this was the only documentary evidence that showed, that established his theory, Dr. Snover's opinion, and his theory that the rate of giant cell formation was inconsistent with a bowel injury a week earlier. He also looked...
Well, he never claimed that these were slides from your client, did he?
No.
What's the difference between him describing it in his professional opinion and him showing up a photograph for illustrated purposes?
I think there's a substantial difference. The difference is that he is showing cases, and he's saying, this case is... Here is what they're claiming happened, and I'm treating this patient, and this is what they're claiming happened, a bowel injury that spills contents into the abdomen. Here's what this looks like. Here's the rate of giant cell formation. You can see that they're different. Here's the scarring. The scarring is here. And he's comparing them with Laura Kaiser's slides. Now, we have no opportunity to learn anything about what he's comparing our client's slides to. And that's where the unfairness occurs. The jury has to accept as gospel, and the plaintiffs have to accept as true, everything that Dr. Snover is telling the jury about these patients and why these unknown patients' slides prove that the foreign vegetable matter predated the cesarean section.
Couldn't the Sioux Valley Hospital doctor that you had used in your case in chief have been put back on to show or to demonstrate that giant cells do build in two to three days with appropriate slides to counter it?
He could have. He could have. He obviously was not a retained expert. He was a fact witness. All he had was the evidence that was presented in the case. He had Laura Kaiser's slides. He was not creating evidence for the plaintiff's benefit. And that's what essentially happened. The defendant's expert created evidence, created slides that he brought in. And we were never allowed to look at those or learn anything about those slides. Yes, Dr. Ort did, in testimony, dispute the conclusions of Dr. Snover. But he had no opportunity to provide exhibits that would have counteracted that, and he had no motive to do so. He was subpoenaed to be there.
Was Dr. Snover's testimony on the stand at trial consistent with his testimony in the deposition?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Ms. Hinton, you have 20 minutes, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Parsons. This case arises out of an infection Mrs. Kaiser developed after a cesarean section. It was a very serious infection. As Mr. Parsons advised the court, a week after the cesarean section, Mrs. Kaiser underwent an exploratory surgery, and during that exploratory surgery, the surgeons decided that a hysterectomy was necessary to treat her infection. After that hysterectomy, Mrs. Kaiser recovered fairly quickly. The issue in the case, when this case was tried last March, the jury had to decide was what caused this serious infection that Mrs. Kaiser developed. The plaintiff's theory about the cause of the infection was that there had been a bowel injury at the time of the C-section.
Were there special interrogatories given to the jury, or was this a general verdict?
Well, it was a general verdict form in that it was one of Judge Sirska's general verdict forms, and he does ask a number of questions in the verdict. For example, do you find that the defendant was negligent? Do you find that there was proximate cause? But the verdict form and the questions are, and the instructions are kind of mixed together, so it's kind of an animal of its own creature.
All right.
The jury was not specifically asked, did you find that there was a bowel injury? Do you find that a bowel injury caused the infection? Or the jury was not asked, what do you find was the cause of the infection or anything like that?
Thank you.
You know, to follow up on that, was there any theory that was presented to the jury other than the time factor about the giant cells and how long they take to develop? It seemed to me that that was the issue that the jury ultimately had to decide liability on?
That's one of the issues, Justice Zinner. You are correct. But the defendants had a number of different reasons to argue, and evidence was presented to the jury that a bowel injury did not cause this infection. One of the things you're right was the timing of the presence of this foreign matter, this plant material, this vegetable matter. But Dr. Snover, the defendant's pathologist, had a completely different theory as to what caused the opinion, a completely different source as to the infection. When a fetus is in utero, it has what's called squamous cells. Sometimes some of those cells slough off, end up in the amniotic fluid. At the time of a C-section, obviously the uterus is opened and the amniotic fluid will spill out into the entire peritoneal cavity. When Dr. Snover looked at the slides of all of the different organs that were removed, he saw these squamous cells. All the pathologists agree they were there. And Dr. Snover saw, associated with these squamous cells, purulent material or pus that would be consistent with an infection that started in Mrs. Kaiser's reproductive organs, spread into the amniotic fluid. So Dr. Snover's opinion was that the cause of this infection, the source of this infection, was an infected amniotic fluid, and that the plant material did not have anything to do with the infection.
Was there evidence about the high white cell count before the C-section?
That is correct, Judge Dauberpool, you are correct. Another reason the defendants argued to the jury that there was no bowel injury that caused this infection was at the time of the C-section, on September 17th, there were already signs that Mrs. Kaiser had an infection. As Justice Dauberpool pointed out, she had an elevated white blood count with a left shift that is consistent with a bacterial infection. She also had an elevated pulse rate that is consistent with an infection, and she had a little bit of a temperature. So there was certainly some evidence that something may have been going on even prior to the C-section.
But had it, under these other theories, it would not have invaded the peritoneal cavity until the C-section. So the giant cell formation issue and the timing of it was still crucial.
Well, it may or may not have, Your Honor. There were, I think, four obstetrician gynecologists that testified, and they explained to the jury this concept of an ascending gynecologic infection. What happens is you have various bacteria that can get into the vagina and ascend or move through the woman's reproductive organs. It gets into the uterus, can spread into the fallopian tubes, and it can spread from the fallopian tubes out into the peritoneal cavity. An infection following a C-section is a recognized risk that can occur in the absence of any violation of the standard of care. And one of the reasons that it can occur is if you have some infection or inflammation of the uterus that after the C-section spreads through the uterus and out into the peritoneal cavity. So that was the defense theory, that there was some infection that originated in the reproductive organs and spread following the C-section.
What was the defense theory for the foreign matter, the plant material, in the amniotic fluid?
Your Honor, we did not have a witness that testified within a reasonable degree of medical certainty or probability as to where that came from. What we did have is every pathologist who testified, Dr. Snover, Dr. Ort, and the plaintiff's pathologist, all agreed that this plant material did not cause and was not the source of the infection. Everyone agreed to that. There was some evidence of potential other sources. Mrs. Kaiser had undergone a number of fertility procedures and different types of invasive testing that could have possibly been a source. So there was some other evidence, but we did not have a specific opinion as to the source. What we did have is, we know it didn't cause the infection. Here's all this other evidence of other causes, and that was what the evidence was. And more importantly, a lot of evidence about the fact that this is not consistent with the bowel injury. Mrs. Kaiser's postoperative course is not consistent with the bowel injury. One of our experts who testified is a general surgeon. General surgeons are the specialists who diagnose and treat bowel injuries. A bowel can be injured by trauma. Some types of disease can result in sudden bowel injury. When that happens, you have a patient become acutely ill within 24 to 48 hours. They're in basically debilitating pain from their abdominal condition. That's not what happened in this case. Mrs. Kaiser didn't even develop a fever until Saturday, nearly at midnight on Saturday night, which is about 5 days after the C-section. Her postoperative course was not consistent with a bowel injury that gives rise to this massive infection. In addition, Dr. Nosneski, the general surgeon, testified that if there had been a bowel injury at the time of the C-section, when Mrs. Kaiser underwent the hysterectomy and exploratory surgery a week later, there would have been some evidence of this bowel injury. Dr. Bell and Dr. George looked to make sure there was not a bowel injury. They didn't find a bowel injury. If there is a bowel injury, it doesn't heal over in a matter of a week, especially if you have an infection going on, because that slows down the healing process. Dr. Nosneski's testimony simply was, there is no way that the bowel could have been injured, caused this infection, and healed over without any signs a week later. That just doesn't happen.
If there's an infection going on for some time prior to the C-section, would it be below the standard of ordinary care for Dr. Dmitrievich not to recognize that or not to do something like give antibiotics or something?
She did, Your Honor. And before the C-section, she gave an injection of an antibiotic to Mrs. Kaiser because of these signs. And after the C-section, she ordered a 24-hour course of antibiotics just out of an abundance of caution. And the only criticism that the plaintiff's experts had of Dr. Dmitrievich was there was an undetected bowel injury and that she should have detected this bowel injury.
Okay. If at the time of the C-section there's no pus present, there's no, you know, the evidence of infection is not present, is it possible that infection can grow so fast so that the whole area is filled with pus within the period of time that we're dealing with?
Certainly, I'll grant you this was an unusual case, and all the experts said it was an unusual case, but they all agreed that this is something that could happen. And, you know, we're talking a period of a week, too. It was, you know, the C-section was about 1 a.m. on Tuesday morning, and it was by Saturday night about midnight when Mrs. Kaiser developed a temperature, and then the next day she had an acute abdominal pain.
Shifting gears a bit, because our time is half gone, Mr. Parsons has said that you violated both the rule, statute or rule requiring you to furnish under the 10-day rule, and you also agreed on top of that to do it, and you violated that too. What's your position on those?
My position, Your Honor, is that we did not violate any discovery rule or any agreement that we had with the plaintiff's counsel. As Justice Zinner pointed out, there clearly was a dispute about the production of literature on which the experts intended to rely. We had a hearing on that, and if you will look at page 19 of that hearing transcript, it was January 4th or 5th of 2005. The judge specifically ordered that any literature on which an expert intends to rely needs to be produced within 10 days. And we did that.
What was the agreement then about other material? Was there any,
no.
Was there an agreement about other material?
No, Your Honor, there was not an agreement about other material. And in fact, there was demonstrative evidence. In fact, Dr. Smith used photographs he took when he examined the very slides he testified about a week before trial. He used photographs that had not previously been disclosed to us. And I didn't object. We didn't have any problem with that because he used those photographs to illustrate and explain the opinions that we'd known about since the day he was disclosed. It was entirely consistent, nothing new.
So let me ask you then, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that the pictures that Dr. Snover had, you intentionally did not disclose them. You intended to have Dr. Snover bring them with him at the time of his testimony, and that was your purpose.
That is not, no, Your Honor, and if I gave that impression, I was wrong. Dr. Snover brought with him 30 photographs that he took of the slides when he examined them in, I think, April of 2004. The plaintiffs knew about those photographs. Those photographs were present at his deposition. He also brought with him 3 new photographs that I did not know about until he arrived the day before he testified. He arrived on Sunday evening with these 3 additional photographs. One of the photographs he told the jury when he testified was of a case that came across his desk on the Friday before. He testified on Monday. It came across his desk on Friday. 2 of the other photographs had come across, had been cases that he'd looked at since his deposition. I don't know when. I didn't know he'd looked at them. Frankly, when he showed them to me on that Sunday night, I didn't cause concern about whether I needed to disclose them because they simply illustrated the opinions that he had told Mr. Abdallah about during his deposition. There was absolutely nothing new. They were entirely consistent.
Didn't they go beyond illustration, though, and really tend to prove or establish the fact that by comparing patient to patient, they really tended to prove that it couldn't have happened this way because of the timing and the growth cycle of giant cells?
Well, Your Honor, I think they simply illustrated the opinions that had been previously disclosed. His opinion with respect to the timing of this plant material was that it had to have been there longer than a week because of the number of giant cells that were surrounding the plant material and the fact that the giant cells were actually starting to infiltrate it. He said that simply could not have occurred within a week. And my plan was, and in fact, Dr. Snover did testify to this. He said he explained how these giant cells form. I mean, you first have 1 or 2 that form, and they're out away, and then they start to move in towards this matter. They surround it, and they start to infiltrate it. And I could have asked him the question, and Dr. Snover, based on your 25-plus years of experience as a surgical pathologist, have you had an opportunity to observe some foreign material that you've known has been present for, say, 2 weeks or a month? He said yes, and can you describe for the jury what that looks like? And he would describe it. Dr. Snover, can you get down and go up to the easel and draw for the jury what you've just described? He could do that and demonstrate those opinions he previously testified about. In this case, and he also showed the jury a photograph. It was nothing new, nothing that was surprising, and it wasn't covered by any order that Judge Sirska had entered, and it, since it wasn't new, it wasn't a different opinion, it was not within the scope of Rule 26E.
Is it your position that there's no verbal agreement, and as long as you comply, as long as you supply something within the 10-day rule, even if the trial has already taken place and is over with, that's sufficient under the rule?
Your Honor, are you referring now to the Judge Sirska's order during the motion hearing or under Rule 26E?
The Rule 26.
I think under Rule 26, we have a duty to seasonably disclose any new information about the substance of an expert testimony, any new or different information.
All right, so if it's new or different information, you acknowledge that you violated the rule here because it wasn't seasonably done, but you're arguing that it wasn't new or different information.
It's not new or different information. It's simply the information used to illustrate the same opinions that Dr. Snover has held from the day we disclosed him. And I think it was Justice Gilbertson who alluded to the fact that, there were both parties used demonstrative evidence, a lot of medical illustrations. We went to Dr. Bell. She's a treating doctor. She gave a videotape deposition for use at trial. I think the plaintiffs marked five medical illustrations used as demonstrative evidence during her deposition. We'd not previously seen those, but again, that was not anything new, anything unusual, and it simply was an aid that Dr. Bell used to help explain her opinions and her treatment to the jury.
And how much time prior to the trial was that video deposition taken?
I think it was within a week or two, Your Honor. I think all the trial depositions were taken early in March, and the trial started on March 15th.
Going back to the duty to seasonably disclose, as I understand your argument today, you're saying there was a duty, but this was not new or different material.
I'm saying under Rule 26, I'm not here. I don't disagree.
Okay.
I mean, if Dr. Snover had come in with new opinions, a different opinion, I have no question that we would have had to disclose that.
Okay, what I understand, at the deposition, he said that he didn't have anything to back up his opinion about the time frame. No demonstrative evidence, no Medline research or anything of that sort. And I know at the trial he said that these exhibits were examples of the time frame that we'd be looking at for this type of inflammatory reaction.
Well,
so wouldn't that be new or different from what he said in his deposition?
Your Honor, the questions that he was asking in his deposition, and they're on page 48 and 49 of his deposition, which are exhibits to my supplemental affidavit of May 12th, the questions were, do you ever recall reviewing any literature or journals or treatises that talk about how long it takes for these giant cells to form? I mean, the question was specifically addressed to literature. In other words, can you point to a passage in a pathology textbook that says it takes a month for giant cells to completely surround a vegetable matter? And his testimony was, no, I don't have any specific literature.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Ms. Hinton. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
The defendants had no alternative explanation for the splattering, the presence, these two sections of foreign vegetable matter on Laura Kaiser's uterus. What this new substantive testimony, we believe this was substantive testimony injecting other cases, other medical cases, other patients into this case without any notice. What this new substantive testimony did was allow the defense expert, Dr. Snover, and the defense in closing argument to say the foreign vegetable matter doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Pay no attention to it. It's a mystery. It'll never be solved. But we have shown you that it could not have been there, that it must have been there prior to the cesarean section. Rule 26E1 requires any additions to the substance of an expert's testimony to be disclosed.
Did the defense counsel use these pictures, these, or argue about them in closing argument?
Certainly the arguments were made. I don't believe the pictures were shown. I don't believe the photographs were shown.
But the photographs were alluded to, you mean, in the argument?
The testimony about the photographs was alluded to. I don't know if the photographs themselves were alluded to. What I've tried to do is explain this to my clients and explain to them how the other side can come to the trial, the only trial they'll ever have on their claims, with things that were never disclosed. And there can be objections about these, and the judge can say, well, I'm just going to allow it. And it comes in. This was the only day that my clients had to have their cause determined in a court of law. And think about this, though. If these photographs were so irrelevant and so collateral to the issues in this case, why the dogfight over whether or not they get in or not? Why do we have a dogfight about whether these photographs that have never going to be that have never been disclosed? Why the fight about getting these in front of the jury?
Why defense counsel mentioned that one of your witnesses, Dr. Smith, brought photos that hadn't been disclosed?
He had photographs of Laura Kaiser's slides. Both sides had equal access to all of Laura Kaiser's slides and medical records.
So those were not a surprise then?
Not a surprise whatsoever. And there was no objection to those because they were not a surprise. The difference in what occurred is that the defense expert, Dr. Snover, came with evidence from other cases that he used to try to prove the point in this case. Maybe that's okay. Maybe experts are allowed to do that. But plaintiffs are allowed to be prepared for that. Plaintiffs are allowed to investigate what the situation with these plaintiffs are, with these other patients are. It's not fair to have this announced at trial right before Dr. Snover takes the stand and have this evidence go in unchallenged and unrebutted. Respectfully request that the new trial standard, or suggest that the new trial standard, has been implicated here. This must have had an effect on the verdict. We can debate all we want about the medical testimony. Every medical point that Ms. Hinton made has a rebuttal to it, but we're perfectly content to allow the jury to decide these complex medical issues. But they can't do so if the form in which they're presented has been obscured by the failure to allow both sides have equal access to evidence that turns out to go directly to the main point in this case. Where did the foreign vegetable matter come from? We're never going to know the answer to that question. But
What about the argument? You heard our discussion with Ms. Hinton. What about the argument about a technical violation? How would you respond to what we talked about?
The issue is not why this didn't come in. I have no criticism of defense counsel whatsoever. They're excellent, great attorneys. What this expert did was show up at trial with new evidence. I believe that violated the letter and spirit of Judge Cirska's commandment at the hearing that anything new is going to be produced. The agreement by defense counsel.
I got to stop you.
Yes.
Because we've been told it's not anything new. We've been told, and from what I've read, it looks like it's really research or literature, new literature.
The motion to compel was focused on literature, brought pursuant because literature was not being provided. At the hearing, the other patients that Dr. Snover referred to was brought up, and that was also part of what was requested as saying we're not getting the things we're requesting. The order, I would suggest, related to anything new, and irrespective of the order at the pretrial hearing, Rule 26E provides anything new related to the substance of expert testimony has to be disclosed. That's, I guess, crystallize this, distill this, that's, I guess, the issue for the court. Is new exhibits, new photographs related to patients of the experts that he's going to use to try to prove his points in this case, is that substantive evidence? That's a question of law, I guess, for this court to determine. We suggest that substantive evidence that needs to be countered if an effective plaintiff's case is going to be made.
Help me understand what will happen if we grant your request for a new trial. Obviously, these photographs that you're complaining about would come in the next trial because you would have had disclosure of them. So what happens then? Do you bring in other experts with other photographs?
No. I think what we do is investigate these photographs, figure out what are the circumstances related to these patients. Now, one of the main points is, hey, these look different. The foreign vegetable matter on this bowel injury looks completely different from Laura Kaiser. Well, one's digested, one's not. Well, where in the bowel was the nick, was the cut, or the perforation in the mystery patient? Was it prior to the digestive process? Where was that spilled? And the rate of giant cell formation, we have no evidence regarding when actually the perforation occurred, how long it took.
So what you would do is get discovery about these other patients, exactly what happened to them, what conditions they were under, and so forth.
We depose Dr. Snover again for sure, and we may well retain counter experts. It's like the Schrader case. This is kind of the corollary to the Schrader case. In Schrader, the defense disclosed experts, and about 3 weeks prior to trial, the plaintiff had its rebuttal experts. And the court said, well, that's untimely, and struck the rebuttal experts. This court reversed and said, no, we're entitled to have rebuttal to expert testimony, the new substance of this. That was too harsh of a remedy. The plaintiff has to be allowed to present counter evidence. Well, here, the what we contend is substantive evidence was not disclosed until day five of trial, 5 minutes before Dr. Snover took the stand. So we had no opportunity to counter that. So we're asking for the same rights that the appellant in Schrader was granted by this court, the opportunity to investigate, to challenge. Maybe we won't come up with anything.
Does that tie in, though, with, you know, the fact that, you know, so at that point, you had to request a continuance? And if you were denied in the continuance, then wouldn't you have been prejudiced?
I think we've preserved our record by fighting the admission of this evidence. We did not ask for a continuance. This is, you know, it was a 2-week trial. The jury had a lot to think about. We did not ask, you know, the scheduling of these types of things is about the biggest nightmare you can imagine, to get all these experts and all these doctors together, and we did not ask that the trial be scuttled at that point. We asked that the evidence not be admitted, and I think that preserved our objection.
No, I agree that it preserves your objection, but it dims it a little bit that you didn't ask for continuance, I guess. You're thinking you needed to take the deposition of that doctor and then get into the records of that patient.
Yeah. And consult with other experts and perhaps retain new experts. I mean, it now becomes the cases within the case. And if we're going to allow the cases within the case into Laura Kaiser's case, we're entitled to do discovery on those cases that are being used to disprove Laura Kaiser's claims. I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.